Blog Talk Radio.
United Wednesday night. Tonight, Irma P. Hall, actress extraordinaire from movies like The Lady Killers and Collateral and A Family Thing. She has a new movie out at South by Southwest that we'll talk about in a little bit. Plus, author Todd Click, who is also a screenwriter. He's written a new book about screenwriting. How you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Good. What's been going on lately? You been all right?
I've been all right. What's going on with you?
Not much. Taking in a lot of movies. You know what I watched again today was Amadeus. God, what a beautiful...
God, I haven't seen that in like 25 years.
That's just a fantastic
movie. It's a great
movie,
yeah.
Gosh. Milos Forman, man.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And outside of that, new releases, did you check out Silent House?
No, I didn't. I figured I cut my losses. That I could wait for.
Mm-hmm.
That I could definitely wait for. Let's see. What do we see?
Well,
John Carter.
It's not a found footage movie. I mean, that's something in this day and age that a horror movie comes out that's not found footage.
I'll watch it when it comes on a DVD or on cable. So I figured I wasn't really missing anything. Was it any good?
It was fine. It's a C+ B- movie.
Right. Yeah, Cinema Score, which I still don't know what I've never been everyone gave it an F. So,
really?
Oh yeah, that and The Devil Inside supposedly like everyone gave an F to. So.
It's leaps and bounds above The Devil Inside, I would think.
I never saw The Devil Inside. I mean, you know, when you get older, you realize, do I really need to see The Devil Inside? Is that really going to be something like on my deathbed? I'm going to be like, I should have seen The Devil Inside.
But you saw John Carter.
I saw John Carter. John Carter, which was much better than anyone gives it credit for.
Yeah?
Much better than anyone gives it credit for. So in every review, we're going to open up, it's $250 million, or $350 million, as the New York Times pointed out on Monday morning. It's really not that bad. It really isn't. It starts off very slow, but the second half is actually pretty good. It's really a very, you know, we talk about all these old-fashioned movies. This is a very old-fashioned movie based on a book that was written, not even a book, it was serialized, a book that was written over a century ago.
Yeah.
If you're familiar with Edgar Rice Burroughs, and you're familiar with any of the Tarzan movies, each of his characters, it's a standard Edgar Rice Burroughs protagonist. There's not a lot to them. You put their fish out of water stories. This isn't that bad. It is a tragedy that the trailer looks like outtakes from Cowboys and Aliens. It's a damn shame for all this money on marketing. You watch a trailer, you're like, you know, this looks like all the outtakes from Cowboys and Aliens. And that's really a shame, because I think that's what people saw. But it's actually not a bad movie. Not a bad movie at all. But we're not going to know. We'll never, you know, it sets up, but you're really curious to see where this is going to go in the next movie. There's never going to be another movie. There can't be. No one has that kind of money. No one's going to be able to recoup their loss, and that's the shame. I don't know why you needed to spend this much money on this movie. There was no reason for it.
Right, right. Well, and obviously the headline is that, like you said, it costs that much money. If it were a great success, then that headline would go away.
Yeah, but see, that's just going to haunt it for years to come. But it's not a bad movie. I'm not saying it's great. I mean, I'd give it like a B, a solid B.
But why spend that much money on a movie where it will not you don't even stand a chance of accomplishing anything exceptional?
What?
I mean, to make something, you know,
old-fashioned. I don't understand what, why you would. They say it was to indulge the Pixar people.
Because of Andrew Stanton?
Yeah, that was the rationale, because that's the whole thing going around. That they're saying it was, you know, they do this, they use the Ishtar analogy because no one wanted to piss off Hoffman and Warren Beatty, which by today's standards, I guess moviegoers, that would make no sense, because neither one of them... But at that time, though, they were both very big. And no one, I didn't understand, I didn't see here that the guy who made, you know, Andrew Sutton's a great, you know, obviously animation director and everything, a great writer and everything, but there was nothing here. I didn't see how, maybe if you would cut, you could easily have cut this thing in half. And I don't think we would have that kind of problem. I mean, it's a shame, because there is, in the second half of the movie, it definitely comes to life. And you have good supporting performances from Mark Strong. Who's it? Someone.
Willem Dafoe's in it.
Willem Dafoe, Dominic. Well, Willem Dafoe, you gotta listen. you gotta listen for the voice. But Willem Dafoe, but is Mark Strong, and Dominic West from The Wire. Mm. And you know, this is a like classic pulp stuff. I mean, but it's also something, unfortunately, that's just not going to translate in this day and age.
The thing that
really gets me is. In the great tragedy is this story is the one that influenced Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers, everything, and the great irony is it comes long after all of these.
Right.
That's really the tragedy right there. Here you have the movie that the property that influenced so much of what we would call modern science fiction and adventure stories and everything, and it's talk about being late to the party.
And I don't even know if you can make a Buck Rogers movie now.
I don't think you could.
And spend a $250 million on a Buck Rogers and have it be, you know, it's just...
Yeah, the test was, here are the two interesting things. Sky Captain of the World of Tomorrow. Fascinating movie. Guy made on his computer. Supposedly that guy was insane to work with. And because he was actually supposed to direct this movie once upon a time, and he would have been a perfect director for it. But
yeah, this
Sky
project's
Captain,
been around forever.
Yeah. Sky Captain didn't do well. That's right there. I think people in 2004 just weren't interested in this kind of old-fashioned storytelling. But then the other thing was sci-fi a couple years ago. Remember, they rebooted the Flash Gordon. They tried to make it a very contemporary, like 21st century version of Flash Gordon, and it went nowhere and died. Like, I don't even think it lasted a season. Yes.
Why don't I remember that movie?
It's not a movie. It was a TV series.
Oh, okay.
They tried to, and it was just a dud. No one watched it, but they tried to really make it, like, I guess, in the vein of Battlestar Galactica and stuff. They tried to, and it didn't work. So those are things I would have looked at if I was in marketing, if I was, like, trying to get this movie made. Say, wait a second, all this other stuff's not working. Why don't we, like, take it down a couple notches?
Well, I mean... You know, there's always an argument of why are we talking about money and not the quality of the film. I guess we would talk about the quality of film over the money, and so would the public if the film were outstanding.
Yeah, the film and people went to go see the movie. I mean,
all the talk about Titanic before it came out was how much damn money it was costing to make. That was not in the dialogue when it became the highest grossing film of all time.
Same with Avatar. I mean,
So.
Well, but it's not really that bad a movie. That's the same. And the same is you actually have, you're really in the last half hour.
But,
you'd like to see it. You would.
But that's what's that's what's terrible about it.
Yeah.
Because if you have $250 million in your back pocket, are you going to spend it on something that ain't that bad?
No, of course not. But here's the thing. That you could have really, you didn't, that's the whole thing. That's the mind-boggling thing. You do see where the money went, but you could be like, all right, do you really need to, this is, I don't care who you are. I don't even care if you're Lucas or whatever. Do you really want to, the problem with this, do you really want to spend this kind of money? Do you really want to put something out there, first of all, in the first week of March, not even the summertime, first week of March? And with it, let's be very honest, it's not a name, unfortunately, it's not a name brand thing. You know,
right.
It's not, You don't have any. There's nothing here that's going to get that prize demographic to the theater.
Well, it's all technology. I had a conversation with Randall Kleiser earlier tonight, and for whatever reason, I mean, he's the director of Grease, but for whatever reason, it veered off into discussions of technology.
Right.
And the fact that, you know, his movie came out, Grease came out, and Grease has a very nostalgic, old-fashioned feel to it even then. It came out on the heels of Star Wars, which changed everything. And Star Wars wowed people. Now, cut 30-plus years later, we're anesthetized to it. There's really very little wow factor. And I think to get a wow factor back, it's got to go – it's probably got to go against technology. You have to return to the roots of every kind of narrative form, which is storytelling. I mean, go back to the basics and learn how to wow us with that.
Right.
Because no matter, we take for granted, of course the special effects are going to be great.
Yeah, even the movie, the special effects are good. And I think that's a problem. It's a mind-boggling thing. But when you actually get through it, it's not like, you know, you're, how should we say it? It's not like Waterworld or The Postman. There is actually something there.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter. And you're watching it. You know, or it's like the other thing, the other movie that came out a couple of years ago, The Golden Compass, part of a trilogy. Not a bad movie. Unfortunately, it didn't make any money. We're never going to see the other two. You know, it's like that. I actually thought this was better than that. But
plus, to kind of widen the scope here, they're not going to lose a lot of money off of it. I don't think. At first, it was reported that they're going to completely lose their shirt on it.
Yeah.
But not so much. I mean, it made $100 million in 3 days overseas.
I think it will break even. Whether it will make a profit, I don't know. But that's
and a lot of times when they have this high risk, a lot of times they cushion it. They cushion themselves. So sometimes when they mount a big movie like this, they can't lose money off of it.
Right.
You know, they've cushioned whatever kind of investment deals they make to a point where, you know, they're in the clear before they even start shooting.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not a bad... It's like I say, it's not like something... Look, I don't know, what does it say about me? The only movie I'm really looking forward to seeing lately is 21 Jump Street, because I need to laugh. I need to see something that's intentionally funny, you know?
21 Jump Street is hysterical.
I can't wait to see it.
And I'm telling you, man, I mean, who would have thought 21 Jump Street
would be the savior of comedy? I mean,
it's an eye-roller kind of concept.
Right.
But, I mean, it works. I mean, it's raunchy. It's hysterical. You know, the two of them together are great. I was really majorly surprised by it. I mean, I laughed out loud many times during it.
Well, that's good, man. That's what a movie like that's supposed to do. Definitely. There are some, like, really good movies out there. Salmon Fishing in the Yemen is superb. Bean Flynn, not so superb, but who's very good in that, I think, is Paul Dano. I think Paul Dano is just, every time I see him, I'm always, like, wowed by how good he is. De Niro's okay. I mean, I guess it's better than Meet the Little Fockers or whatever those movies are called, but...
you know, yeah, I'm curious. I mean, Paul Dano, you know, he makes a great impression everything he's in, so...
Yeah,
If agents now actually use the term Book 'em Dano for him to get him a new job. Anyway.
Yeah.
Luck. HBO just...
Yeah, what? Now, I saw that on our Twitter feed. What happened exactly?
It was announced tonight that they've canceled the series because of... well, first, when I heard that there was animal abuse on Luck, I'm like, somebody slapping around Nick Nolte? I had no idea. But three horses have died on the set, on the production. So they've canceled the series outright because they said we can't guarantee that we'll be able to prevent further accidents. Now, what hasn't been really covered is this a result of the production at all? And I don't think that any of them are. No. One of them, I think, was injured in the production. But the other two, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Not the latest one. I mean, the latest one, they're walking the horse back to the stall, and the horse kind of geared up and fell back, and, you know.
Now, let me ask you this. I have not watched this. I'll probably try to watch this in repeats or whatever, but was this a good show?
Now, be honest
with me. I mean...
Yeah, I'm going to.
Okay.
You have loyalists to it, I guess, but... I just think it's, for the most part, it's deadly dull. And none of the storylines particularly interest me.
Mm-hmm.
They're too slow going.
Right.
I mean, I've heard of a slow burn, but if you were to watch the series so far as a 10-hour movie, you'd be
like,
wow,
10 hours, wow.
What the hell has been happening? What the hell happens in it? I mean, it's not dynamic television. It's beautifully... photographed. It's got a definite sense of place, as all Michael Mann productions do.
Mm-hmm.
But and also episodic TV, when you have such great actors like a Hoffman and a Nolte, their scenes are so brief. I mean, their scenes are like a minute in duration, and then it goes to the other four storylines, and then comes back to them. It doesn't allow them to get any kind of rhythm going at all. I mean, none of the scenes have a kind of momentum to them or a build at all for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know who's great in it is Michael Gambon. I mean, he's somebody that can play very intimidating with just, you know, a look. I mean, he's just...
He's a fantastic actor. I mean, all three of them are. Now, I have a question to ask you. A couple of years ago, there was a series on HBO that lasted one season, and it was about a surfer. What was that called?
John from Cincinnati.
Okay. I never got a chance to watch that. I'd like to go back and watch that because I actually
Garrett Dillahunt.
Good.
Garrett Dillahunt, who we've had on a couple of times, he was the star of that one.
Yeah, and I want to watch. I just never got a chance to watch it, and I've been wondering what was that show, because there are people who were really bummed that it never got renewed. So I mean, I was very curious to I want to go back and watch that at some point.
Yeah, I never checked it out either. But, you know, I mean, everybody's probably going to be saying that it was PETA saying that you need to stop production. It was their strong-arming that led them to shut it down, which I think is half right.
Right, right.
If this thing were a Sopranos-sized hit, they wouldn't have shut it down.
No.
But
it sounds like, so.
The show does like 625,000 viewers, which isn't very good.
No, not even for HBO. In the early days, that might have been good, but not now.
So in the face of such bad press, it's not worth it to them, you know?
Right. No, of course not.
So anyway, there you have it.
Okay.
The Walking Dead, have you been paying attention to that?
I've been paying attention to that. We got one more episode. I think what they need to do next season is they got to get off the farm, first of all. But this season's been a disaster, I think. It's like what we were talking about a couple weeks ago with Twin Peaks. The first season, that half season of Twin Peaks was awesome. That first six episodes, or however long Walking Dead was incredible. Once you get to the second season, I think it's stalled. Something happened. Now, of course, they've had some flashpoints, some big, you know, big surprises. We're not going to talk about them on the show.
I think it's given itself a shot in the arm these past two episodes.
I think the past two episodes, yeah.
Yeah.
But before that, I mean...
Oh, yeah, yeah, it was pretty stagnant.
The first
but,
half of the
season,
before the mid-season finale, I was just like, whatever, I mean...
This half of the second season, which I think is just stupid, it should just be called season three, but this second part of the second season, I think has been really good, like really well-directed, really kind of great incidences in it, you know. Water cooler stuff. I mean, people are kind of wowed by it again. Mm-hmm. So let's see
how long. That's good. I mean, because they had something really good to go with there. So, you know, we'll have to see what happens. I guess next season will be like the pivotal season to find out see what this show can do. But I think, yeah, definitely, and especially the last two episodes. Wow.
Yeah.
It means wow.
So, tonight, Irma P. Hall, we'll get to this interview now. Aaron Nadadiaz, our home entertainment correspondent, conducted this interview for us.
Cool.
South by Southwest, she is a film at that festival that's still going on now.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk a little bit about the festival after this interview. Her film is called Wolf. It's written and directed by Yaki Smith, who joins her in this interview. It concerns a teenage boy and the story of his sexual molestation at the hands of a trusted minister, and how the minister, how the entire family deals with this, and the church. It's very relevant. It's very dramatic and somber, and explores this difficult theme head on. Its next and last showing at South by Southwest takes place on Friday. And here they are, Irma P. Hall and the writer-director of the film, Yaki Smith.
Every time we did it, I loved you more and more.
I thought I was special.
Then you're gonna turn around and leave me?
Nona, how you doing?
I'm good, Bishop. That was a good word.
Y'all pulled on God. God pulled on me. How's everything with you, Carl?
Good.
How long are you here for?
Yeah, just for a few days.
Your daddy loves you. He's just trying to make a better life for us.
Hey, Carl.
Hey.
The saying, only the strong survive, embodies in a nutshell how wolves choose their prey.
You won't hurt me no more.
Life! Now!
We've all made mistakes. Don't go putting God's business in the street.
This perversion has eaten away at you because you haven't dealt with it properly.
Oh, yeah, devil, you letting him go.
Why you defending him?
Take this blackness from my heart.
There's not enough evidence to move forward in your case.
The enemy ain't lurking in no shadows, Grandmama. He's right there in our face, laying his disgusting hands on us every day.
I know, it hurts. Pain makes us who we are.
He should pay, and he will pay. But not out there. Because if he pays out there, we all pay.
You see, nothing good has ever been accomplished without bloodshed. And you want to be great.
I'll start with you, Yaki, in that what was the, tell me about the genesis of this story and what made you want to deal with such a, you know, obviously a very tough subject matter.
You know, I think the seeds of this story have lived inside of me for a while. It wasn't until later on, after I actually started writing, that I started to remember when I was young, how I had many friends who'd actually been molested, and they would sort of come to me and tell me their stories. You know, I don't know why people thought I was like a father or something, so they would, you know, come to me for advice and things like that. And it was weird because those stories sat inside of me, and I sort of buried them in the back of my brain, and I didn't really think about them anymore. And then about 3 years ago, I was laying in my bed watching a film called Deliver Us from Evil, which is about a priest who had molested, this guy's molested like more than 50 kids. And it was interesting because they interviewed him, but they also interviewed the victims who are now, you know, 20 and 30-year-olds. And it was one of the first times where I thought I'd seen a pedophile, you know, given some sense of humanity, because it wasn't like the filmmakers were trying to excuse what he did, but they went back and they showed us sort of why he became what he became, how he himself was a victim, how he himself suffered through the same trauma that he was now inflicting on other people. And I wanted to craft a story that sort of showed that showed this guy who was a monster, but who was also a human and who was sort of fighting that monster, as well as deal with a story that showed the fallout of that and how a family sort of, you know, suffers through that after being betrayed by someone who they love and trust and someone who they really revere. And so I wanted to tell a story from both of those vantage points.
And Irma, I'll ask you, you know, this is obviously a very tough subject matter, and I was wondering what attracted you to this story?
Well, the honesty of it attracted me, because I was a school teacher for 24 years, primarily secondary education, and I had a lot of boys. I think it's because as a teenager and in college, I had been an athlete, and I had run track, so maybe that was it. I don't know. But at any rate, I know I have run into some young men who made me their confidant. And I often thought that it's something that should be discussed more, and they should have had somewhere where they felt free to talk. And unfortunately, a lot of them didn't have fathers present. And also, I was also reminded, because I came from a family where I had a wonderful father, and I knew I could talk with him about anything. My father had been a musician, played with big bands during the 30s to 40s era, and he had told me always that I could always talk with him about anything. So whenever I run into young people who can't talk to their parents about something, and that's interesting to me. And I thought it was something that needed to be done and told, and I liked the way it was handled. I liked the way it read, and it was still in the beginning stages. I mean, he was still writing the script. It wasn't a finished script yet. So I was attracted to it.
But Yaki, I'll ask you this. Your film seemed to, obviously this one seemed to have a very social awareness of, you know, topics that are very much in the now, right? You know, at the moment, in the moment. And I'm curious if that's the kind of filmmaking and storytelling you seem to gravitate towards.
Yes, you know, it's interesting because one of the reasons why I want to become a filmmaker, don't get me wrong, I love movies and I've always loved movies and I've watched movies. But the one thing about films that really, really made me want to become a filmmaker was that I knew that they had power in them. They had power to change people's mindsets on certain situations. And then they had power to expose us to things that we hadn't, you know, been exposed to before we saw those particular films. I think the film that really, really made me want to be a filmmaker was Boys in the Hood, you know, because for the first time I saw, you know, sort of gang members or people from more urban areas who were involved with gangs and drugs. I saw them as humans, you know, and I grew up in those areas, and so I knew that those people were not all bad. I knew that those people sort of were not the evil characters that the media had portrayed them to be. And so that film for me, it showed that, and not only did it show it, but it caused other people to see into those homes and to really see the humanity in those characters. And it caused people who were, you know, maybe in gangs or whatnot to really, you know, stop for a moment and think about, like, the consequences of their actions and really question, like, is this something that they want to be doing for the rest of their lives? And the power in that film really made me want to be a filmmaker, because I knew then that I could use film as a tool of change, and that's why I make films now.
Well, and to follow up on that, in that you know, you've done some shorts before this, your first real feature film, and so I'll ask you if what was the transition from going to shorts into feature, and was there a difference?
It's a huge difference. You know, it making a short, it's you know, you shoot for 6 days, you know, you do all the pre-production, and I think you can get a good short together in 3 or 4 weeks, you know, pull all the crew together, go, you know, over storyboards and shot lists or whatnot with the DP, pull the cast together. You could do that in a month or two. But with the feature, it's such a big feast, you know, for lack of a better term, that it takes so much time. And transitioning from those shorts to the features, it was difficult for me, quite honestly, because I didn't realize how much time it was going to take. Just the planning of it all, because I'm also one of the producers of this film. So I was also in the planning stages of finding locations and casting and trying to find food and just trying to pull all of those little things together, as well as just trying to, you know, find some money. And that sort of transition, it was a huge leap, and it was difficult. Now, as far as the storytelling is concerned, you know, I use the same story structure, the same heart that I put into my shorts, I put into this feature. Working with the actors was a little challenging because there were so many of them. You know, I'm used to working with maybe 3 or 4 actors at one time, but never really having to direct 8, 9, 10 actors in such an emotionally role, you know. And so, you know, it was a difficult leap, but I hope that, you know, I did it well, you know. I know there's a lot of things that I did wrong this time that I would not do again.
Go ahead, Irma.
Oh, I had seen his short film, and I've been in this business now over 40 years, so, and I've worked with a lot of different directors. And I had confidence in him as a director, and I felt that he could expand on the story, because this could have been a short, but I do know that being a director is not just about tweaking the performances of the actors. All of the bucks and nickels and dimes and everything else stop right on the director's desk, and they have to do all of that. But from what I had seen before of his work, I felt confidence that he could do this, tell this story and expand it and handle all of this. And I think that that confidence came from a confidence that I have always had in young people. I also was aware of situations the young people grow up in, because I grew up on the south side of Chicago. Even though I was born in Texas, but from third grade through high school, I was in Chicago on the south side. And we had a lot of the same problems that exist now. I tell young people when I'm talking to them now, these things are not new. I mean, we had drugs. Heroin was the drug, the most popular drug in those days. But I had seen people in the throes of drugs. I've seen, we had gangs. We had just about the same problems, which is one reason why I wanted to teach secondary, because I knew the circumstances, knew the problems. I grew up in a neighborhood with families with same kinds of problems, and I felt I could help those kids. So that kind of background we had. Now, as an actor, to me, it's just another form of teaching. There's something that you want to spread the word, and this gave me an opportunity to be a part of telling a story, bringing something to light that I felt was very important. And like I said, because I had seen his work before, I felt confident that he could do it.
Well, and I want to ask you this, Irma. You've done, obviously, you said 40-year career, and so you've been in indies, you've been in mainstream films, and you've worked with, you know, obviously here, you know, first-time feature filmmaker, but you've also worked with, obviously, you know, people like Michael Mann and the Coen brothers and so forth.
Yes.
So I'm curious if there is one or two characteristics that you've picked up over the years that, I guess, you know, signals the good directors from the ones that, you know, have been a little less, you know, a little more troublesome or something, you know, to put it diplomatically.
Fortunately for me, I have been extremely fortunate. I've never had a bad experience. I say sometimes maybe it's because of what my grandmother used to tell me, that a lot of the problems that you have are because of what you bring to the table. And so I bring to the table love, cooperation, preparation. I'm ready. I built my reputation on being a 1 or 2 take actor. I can follow directions. I'm a team player. So I don't have a problem with that. My main problem always is what is the truth that is being told, and this rang of truth, and that's the thing. That's what I like to do. I choose to play older women because when I was discovered by Raymond St. Jacques, he asked me. He said, "Now, as an actor, you have to decide what it is you want to do. And I said, well, because older women have always played such an integral part in my life, I would like to be their voice. I'd like to be the voice of all the voiceless older women that no one pays any attention to. It's my way of saying thank you to them. So, and I choose that. As directors, you have some directors, I guess, who choose to tell different stories, you know, stories about different things. Yaki, from what I have seen, has chosen to tell stories about what is going on actually today and shed light on them and make people look at them a different way rather than just like listening to the news and hearing a bank was robbed and they caught the bank robber and maybe he was 13 to 21 years old and they put him in jail and that was it. He goes into depth what was the reason, because I have always been curious as to why people do whatever they do. My mother says that my first word was why. So, and instead of mom and daddy like other kids, I looked up one day and said, why? But I've always known that when children are 5, 6 years old, they don't say, I'm going to grow up one day and be a murderer, or I'll grow up one day and be a drug addict, or grow up one day and be a pedophile. It all starts somewhere. And even in his short, it explored the reasoning behind relationships, how they develop and into whatever they develop into.
Right. Well, Yaki, to start wrapping us up, how did the screening go last night, and what's next, you know, for the film? What's next for the film?
The screening went really well. It was to capacity. We had to turn people away, and we actually got a standing ovation. You know, I couldn't sit during the screening. I was like standing on the side, just sort of looking out at people's reactions and kind of pacing, you know, really nervous about it. But it looked good, and it sounded great, and people really, really, really responded to it. And not in that, like, oh, it was good, but really, like, it touched them. You know, I had several people after the screening come up to me, hug me, look at me, and tell me, thank you for telling my story. Thank you for telling a story like this, because this is something that needs to be told. Because there's so many victims who are in the shadows, who've never been able to come out, who've never been able to tell anyone that they were victimized. But when they see a story like this, they know that they're not alone. And so I know that this story really, really hit home with a bunch of people in the audience. As far as what's next, we're actually going to be screening at the Dallas International Film Festival in April. We're waiting to get the exact dates. I'm not for sure when they are yet. But that'll be our second premiere, which is really great. And then we're out to a slew of film festivals right now waiting on responses. And, of course, we're hoping that one of the big distributors will pick us up and take this film to the nations. That's the goal.
Right. Well, Yaki Smith, congratulations. It's a powerful piece of work. And Irma, you're truly a force to be reckoned with, and it's great to talk to you. I'm a big fan of A Family Thing. I think that's just a wonderful movie.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed that, too. All right.
All right. That is actress Irma P. Hall and her writer-director Yaki Smith for the new film Wolf. It's showing again at South by Southwest on Friday, so check it out if you're attending that festival or in that area.
Okay. Interview. I like really when he does interviews, and I'll say it again, like when you guys are talking about Hugo back at Thanksgiving, that was really an awesome conversation. Like I said, you guys really sold the movie, I think, to anyone listening.
Oh, good. I think it's the reason why it won so many Oscars, personally.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, no, really.
Hey, you know, the other person I talked to earlier today, and everyone will hear it on Sunday, was Abel Ferrara.
I read a great biography of him a long time ago.
The guy that wrote that biography, he also wrote a piece on Full Metal Jacket. I've been trying to track him down so I could so I can include him in the Kubrick series. But yeah, but Abel Ferrara.
Well, I can't wait to hear this.
I mean, it's a typical. It's you know, it's a good enough 10-minute conversation. But something unexpected happened at the end of it, where I told him how much I said I appreciate your. You and I, you know, I appreciate your films very much. And he said, thank you. He said, I love you. and I said, I love you too, man. And then we hung up. It was like the most surprising exchange with Abel Ferrara. So to hear Abel and I express our love for one another, tune in on Sunday.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. And then next Wednesday is Barry Bostwick. He's in a great, funny new movie called Some Guy Who Kills People. Then the following Sunday is Morgan Spurlock. He has his Comic-Con
documentary. Oh, yeah, that's right. And that's going to be, you said in the thing, though, in the show description, that should be on video on demand starting in April?
I believe so. Yeah, April 6th, yeah. I think.
Cool. All right. Yeah, his last movie was pretty good. I like the greatest movie ever sold or whatever.
Right.
That was
right.
Hilarious. I mean.
And then there's a new documentary out about Mr. Rogers from two guys that actually knew him.
Wow.
So we're going to talk about Mr. Rogers too in an upcoming show.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting topic. I mean, who is Mr. Rogers? I mean, we don't really. We never really considered who is he really. I mean, is he Mr. Rogers as we'd seen him on television all those years? Or?
I think he may have been.
Yeah.
That's really a fascinating. That should be awesome, actually.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
We should actually bring on and interview his neighbor. I mean, that would be interesting. And then we're putting together the next episode of the Kubrick series about Full Metal Jacket. We got turned down by Arlie Ermey and told that he's talked out about Full Metal Jacket, essentially. There's nothing new to add, which I can empathize with.
I can imagine. I could honestly see that. I mean.
But, you know, the bad news is this episode is a little less complete because it doesn't include him. But.
Mm-hmm.
It does include Matthew Modine and you know about a dozen other people so far, and we're talking to a couple of more people associated with it. So we're currently trying to put it together to air it in April.
Okay.
Let everyone know. Also, in April we're going to have a quickie 5-night series, a music on film series, where the movies we'll be talking about are West Side Story. And I want you to hum some songs whenever I mention these movies, Jerry.
Okay.
Go ahead. West Side Story.
You don't. You want people to get into the show. You want people. You want the numbers to go up, not go down. I mean.
Cabaret.
Oh wow! Who are we going to talk to about from Cabaret?
I don't know yet.
Okay.
I got turned down by Liza. They said she's going to be talking about Cabaret in January. So write us back then.
I may be dead by January. Come on.
I know, but I'm thinking
my co-host could be dead by January.
I'm thinking, why January? And I'm, you know, because it was released in '72, so this is the this is the 40th anniversary of it, right?
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking, why January? And I thought maybe that's the Blu-ray release.
Oh, that's,
maybe
that's
what
a possibility.
That is.
Possibility, yeah. I mean,
yeah, but I, you know, I reached out to Joel Grey and. I'm kind of fascinated by Bob Fosse. I mean, I know his stage background, but I'm fascinated by Bob Fosse as a filmmaker. So I'm anxious to explore that. And then Grease, Amadeus, and Purple Rain. So that'll be
wow.
The 5 nights. And the reason why we chose these 5 is because they're among 5 in a series of books called Music on Film. From Hal Leonard, and so the authors of every book will be on too. So it's in connection with that series of books. That's why we're not choosing, you know, Oklahoma or South Pacific or Harold and Maude or any other movies that you know use music. By the way, Harold and Maude, Criterion pushed the release of that back 2 months.
Oh, okay.
I wonder why.
I have no idea. Wow. All right.
That's about, you know, what a a release that everyone was looking forward to, too.
Yeah, definitely.
Major. I'm sure they'll still be looking forward to it in 2 months, but there you go. So that's upcoming on the show. Jerry, what do you think is the best? I mean, we talked about this a little bit with The Shining. What do you think is the best Stephen King film adaptation?
I think, you know, one of my favorites, and what we talked about this actually, was The Dead Zone is a personal favorite. That gets lost a lot. But I mean, if I had to really, I might go out on a limb and say like Carrie or The Shawshank Redemption.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but there are actually, you know, remember there's a period where there weren't a lot of good ones. But then if you really think about it, there are. I mean, Carrie, The Shining, The Mist, The Shawshank Redemption, The Dead Zone, Misery, Stand By Me. I mean, there really
are. Yeah, I mean, when you look at a track record, I mean, you know, there are lots of duds and not so good movies, but, you know, there are 50, 60 movies, however many there are from Stephen King, you know. It's a good enough batting average. Well, Total Film came out with a list. This is our list for the evening.
Okay.
Worst to best Stephen King movies.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. The Mangler 2 at number 50. I guess no argument there.
I had no idea that there was a sequel.
Children of the Corn Revelation, number 49, 2001.
Oh, my God.
Graveyard Shift.
Oh, that's the one with the giant rat?
Yes.
Okay.
47, Pet Sematary 2. Don't remember a thing about Pet Sematary 2.
I remember the first one.
Children of the Corn 666, Isaac's Return, number 46.
Why is it all these Children of the Corn sequels are going to be on here?
You know that you had to have some bad movies in your corner where there are actually four movies that are worse than something called Children of the Corn 666, Isaac's Return.
I know, that's really, you know, that says something right there.
Number 45, The Rage, Carrie 2.
I could definitely, I would put that on there, I guess. I mean, it's a bad movie. I thought we were talking about direct, like, adaptations, not things that his name is on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is going to be very interesting. These are already down here. Oh, my God.
Yeah, this is the bottom of the barrel. But they're rebooting Carrie now, and the Broadway musical just came back, too, which is the original mounting of that musical is known as one of the great duds in Broadway history.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, they've improved it a bit. Children of the Corn 3, Urban Harvest at number 44. It must have been big direct-to-DVD sellers for them to make that many of them.
Yeah.
The Original Mangler at number 43.
This is fascinating. These are down so low. Okay.
You know what the plot description of the Mangler is? Detective John Hunton, played by Ted Levine.
Go Ted!
Investigates when it seems a laundry folding machine has acquired a taste for human flesh.
Oh my God, I remember this was advertised all over TV when it came out.
When you find yourself writing that, do you think you're kind of written out?
Yeah, I mean, really, what's next? The dishwasher of death, I mean.
I'm fresh out, guys. Number 42, Children of the Corn 5. Fields of Terror. Eva Mendez was in that.
Way to go, Eva.
Number 41 from 2002, Firestarter 2, Rekindled. I wasn't even aware there was a sequel.
I had no idea. Who plays the Drew Barrymore part? I mean,
Marguerite Moreau.
I hope she got a big payday for that.
Yeah, sure. Number 40, Children of the Corn 2, the Final Sacrifice.
And it was nothing final about it, judging from the other.
No, it wasn't. Number 39, okay, here's the first, like, legitimate movie on the list. Number 39, Dreamcatcher.
Oh, that was disappointingly and bad in such a way you're just like, what the fuck's going on
it's
here?
It's too bad because, I mean, Larry Kasdan. You know,
I know, you would think, you know. I mean, it had a great cast and everything, and it just was ridiculous. I mean,
ahead of that, number 38, Sleepwalkers. Machen, what's her name? Machen Amick?
Yeah.
She was one of those great early 90s babes.
Yes,
right?
She was. Yes, she was. This was probably, I guess this was her big claim to fame at the time.
Number 37. She was also in Twin Peaks.
That's
she?
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 37, Children of the Corn, 4, The Gathering.
I always put them all like that. These movies suck.
I think part 4 is getting short shrift here.
Yeah, I think so too.
Number 36, there are 14 Stephen King movies that they consider worse than Maximum Overdrive at number 36.
That's saying something. Wow.
Yeah. Stephen King's one and only time behind the director's chair. Number 35, Riding the Bullet.
And that's by Mick Garris, who is like considered like the nose, very good at adapting. I've never seen Riding the Bullet, so I don't know, but I mean.
Yeah, yeah. Wasn't it the name, the title of the memoir by Steve McQueen's ex-wife? Number 34, The Lawnmower Man.
That's not, you know, that movie's like really weird because that's like at the whole beginning of the virtual reality
right.
phrase, really.
Pierce Brosnan, Jeff Fahey. You know what's funny about that? It has zero resemblance to the story.
Oh, yeah, he came out and said that immediately. I mean,
it's one of my favorite stories. I forget what book it's in, but it's one of my favorite Stephen King short stories. But there's nothing in the movie that's in the book. I mean, it's just completely...
Right.
Tommyknockers.
I remember that I remember that was a big deal when it came out.
Tommyknockers, number 33.
That was made for TV, right? That was a TV miniseries.
Yes, it was.
With Tracy Lords, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Tommyknockers, also the title of the memoir for Tommy Mottola's ex-wife. Number 32 is Thinner.
I would put that down further, but I mean, that was pretty bad.
Really? You put it below Children of the Corn, 666?
Well, I don't know. No, it's a little bit better than Children of the Corn, but it's not, I mean, it's just like really run-of-the-mill, nothing really spectacular.
Yeah. Yeah.
The concept, I think, is more interesting than the actual movie.
That was the period where they made so many of them, and most of them were disposable. Number 31, our reigning champion, the original Children of the Corn.
Wow.
Remember who the female lead in that was?
I don't. I know as soon as you say it, I'll be like, oh, yeah, but...
Linda Hamilton.
She's
the
come
same
a long
year,
way.
Well, the same year that The Terminator came out.
Wow.
Yeah. So things worked out. Number 30, Creepshow 2.
Oh, God. I would think that would be down lower, but now I'm really curious to see what's coming up.
Number 29, The Night Flyer. Okay.
Nondescript, really.
Dolan's Cadillac. I know that that's a short story, I think, from Nightmares and Dreams. I didn't. Wes Bentley and Christian Slater. I didn't even know that was a film. Okay.
I didn't even know that either. Wow.
Number 27, Tales from the Dark Side, the movie. Number 26. So, number 26. Now, this is a movie that a lot of people love. We talked to Dee Wallace about it. Cujo,
I think it would be higher up. I mean...
Yeah, I think it should be. I think Cujo's...
But we're at the halfway mark, though, aren't we now? We're, like, getting towards, so...
Yeah, but somehow there's 25 better movies than Cujo in Stephen King's resume. I think it's a good, effective, really effective movie, and a difficult movie to make effective. You know? It all takes place in a car with a dog, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
Okay. The Dark Half, number 25.
I remember seeing that in a theater. That was all right, you know? That was interesting.
Yeah, George Romero. Number 24 is Firestarter.
Wow, okay. I'm just really curious what's coming up, you know? I mean,
23 is Needful Things.
That was decent. I mean, that was a decent movie. I mean, I don't... you know, Max von Sydow was great as the, you know, the devil. I mean, can't ask for a better.
Yeah, and Ed Harris, good cast.
Ed Harris, I mean, that was a good, that's a really underappreciated adaptation.
I think it is, too. Silver Bullet, number 22.
Man, that wolf looked like the Coors Beer Wolf when we saw it. That's all I got to say. It looked like the Coors Silver Bullet Wolf, but that's just me.
Yeah. Something's wrong, though, when you when you put Gary Busey in a Stephen King film and he's not scary. I mean, yeah.
Today you would be.
Make a documentary about Gary Busey. It'll be scarier than Silver Bullet. Cat's Eye, number 21. Never crazy about that. There's something. There's a story in there about James Woods, though, trying to quit smoking or something.
In which one? Cat's Eye?
In Cat's Eye, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
I remember that. Number 20 is Secret Window with Johnny Depp.
That was a pretty good movie. That was pretty good.
19 is Pet Sematary.
We used to watch that all the time. When that first came on VHS in college, we watched that like that weekend when it came out. And it's your cat
it's
now.
It's the only book that ever scared me. Like, reading the book scared me. And I wasn't used to, you know,
right,
being scared by a book. Number 18 is Christine. They just had a midnight showing of Christine at my local drive-in. I wish I would have known about it ahead of time, but that would have been interesting.
I
like Christine. I think it's an effective movie.
Mm-hmm.
Number 17, Toby Hooper's Salem's Lot.
The miniseries.
Yes, 79.
Now, I remember that was a big deal when that came on. I mean, people couldn't stop talking about it.
I thought it was good. I mean, in the 70s, I think it probably pushed the boundaries of television, what you were allowed to do on television.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. I remember David Soul and the elbow patches on his jacket. I mean,
right.
They're such a 70s kind of thing. It's funny the things that you remember.
Yeah, no, I
Because I'm watching Salem's Lot like decades ago with a girlfriend of mine at the time, and I'm like, seriously, could David Soul's jeans be any tighter? I mean, seriously, he was wearing the tightest freaking jeans I've ever seen.
Oh my God, man, you really do, right?
And my girlfriend was like, she was like, I know, what's... It's like he's making cream of wheat or something. it makes no sense, but so somehow it's funny. Somehow it does make sense, that phrase. Okay, that's number 17. Number 16 is The Running Man.
Okay, yeah.
I think it's the finest movie Richard Dawson's ever been a part of.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're using that as the yardstick, yeah. I mean,
a good Harold Faltermeyer score.
Mm-hmm.
Number 15 is Creepshow from 1982, the original Creepshow.
Yeah, you got to put that first one is.
That
was
good.
A big deal in junior high. So.
Number 14 is Apt Pupil.
Now here's Rick. I like this movie. I know a lot of people don't, but I always like the novella, and I thought it was well done. I mean, I thought it was good. You know, it's a movie that no one ever talks about, but.
No.
And it's, you know, because it's the follow-up to Usual Suspects
yes.
of Bryan Singer. But it is it's not a bad movie. It's actually very interesting. And, you know, one of the actors is dead from it. So,
yeah.
So, I never thought this was a bad movie, as people said.
I think
disappointment for people expecting another Usual Suspects, maybe, but...
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think that's what it is. This is interesting. Number 13, Hearts in Atlantis.
Well, that is, see, now we're getting into stuff I've read.
Emotionally
the book, and I didn't mind the movie. The movie, remember, came right after September 11th.
Yeah. Directed by Scott Hicks, I think it was like his follow-up to Shine. I remember being totally underwhelmed by it. I never watched it after that opening night at the theater.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's open for rediscovery, this movie. Emotionally complex and moving, this is one of the more low-key King adaptations.
It's very low-key.
But is all the better for it.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, you know, Hopkins and Stephen King, So the expectations might have been, you know, maybe he's going to do mm-hmm. something scary, and you know, he didn't. But 1408 at number 12.
That's a good movie. That's a good.
Yeah.
That's a solid movie.
Number 11, It. I'd like to see that made into a feature.
Hmm. Kate, let me ask you this: for a book that thick, that is there a way to condense that? I mean,
no,
to do it
no,
justice.
My idea for it, which you know, I'm not in the running for the job, but my idea for it has always been like dividing into two separate films: the childhood and the adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be two different films. Just
right.
as Stephen King argues that The Stand needs to be two different films. By the way, Ben Affleck's doing The Stand, which I think is great news. But they picked up The Dark Tower again. Warner Brothers is considering it again. So
now this is going to be how are
it's
they
not,
now?
Not dead yet, that project. You know.
Well, I think the best way to approach that is, quite honestly, do what they're doing with Game of Thrones on HBO. Make each book a series. Like 8 or 10 part series.
Yeah.
That's the
only
way I think you can really do it.
Their idea has been to do it as a feature and then carry it over into television.
That's
a
good idea,
yeah.
but risky.
I think, you know, imagine, I mean, Warner Brothers owns HBO. Or,
mm-hmm.
I mean, do it as an HBO miniseries, exactly. I mean,
yeah,
that would be...
God,
what a ratings bonanza that would be, you know?
Dude, and all HBO, and HBO could do something with every, like, with Comcast and Fios, make, like, a special when that comes on, like, a special, like, deal. Because, you know, a lot of people, believe it or not, don't, you know, we like to think everyone has HBO, but they really, a lot of people don't have HBO. And this would be a good way, like, a promotional thing for each time the first, like, the premiere episode, offer, like, customers who don't have or just who have basic cable, offer them a sweet deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you could really do a lot with this.
Yeah, I agree. We're going to bring on Dean for the final 10 here. I just thought his call is in. Hey, Dean.
I'm going to play his theme music.
Oh, okay. Hang on. Dean, hang on. I'm putting you on hold again.
All right.
All right. Just pretend like that moment didn't happen.
Okay.
All right. We're about to bring on Dean to review our final 10 of our best Stephen King adaptations. Dino. All right, Dean, you're back.
All right.
Perfect.
I love it.
Hello.
Great. All right, number 10.
All right, Dean, how are you, man?
What an absurd list so far.
Yeah. Number 10 is The Stand.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you can top Gary Sinise as the lead in that. I mean, Gary Sinise just seemed perfect as the lead
in
that
first
movie.
That first night was just awesome.
Yeah.
Just incredible.
Yeah, it begins better than it ends, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can top the movie itself. But Gary Sinise just seemed like perfect casting
mm-hmm.
for that.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Number 9. The Dead Zone is number 9.
Okay, that's definitely a
wow, that's low,
underappreciated, but it's good that it's on there. I'm surprised it's that high, but I'm happy it is.
Yeah, I agree. It does need to be higher, but yeah, it's one of the greats. Number 8 is The Mist.
I like that movie a lot, but a lot of people hate that movie because they changed the ending and they didn't like the ending. People really, you know, we talk about polarizing movies like Drive and things of that nature. Remember when The Mist came out? Well, it was a dud. I mean, not the exact movie you want to release on Thanksgiving when the whole family's home, but remember how polarizing that movie was? Four years ago, and it was people really either loved it or hated it. And
wasn't
really
the movie? Didn't
it,
didn't the movie end like very abysmal? Like no hope whatsoever.
No hope, and then he turns. You know, and then he didn't have to do what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like
right. I remember.
It's
devastating. I thought that was so ballsy.
Yeah, it was incredibly ballsy. But people really, the people who liked it, like me, really liked it. But then the people who hated it, oh my God, you would have thought they'd gotten hit by a car or something. I mean,
yeah,
oh my
how
God.
Dare you? How dare you do that to me?
Yeah.
Happy thanks. Happy holidays, everybody.
Yeah.
I did like that movie quite a bit.
Yeah. I did too. Number
really
seven
good.
Is a movie I like, Dolores Claiborne.
That is a good. It's an underappreciated one too.
I haven't seen that in forever. It might be time to revisit that one.
Oh, the editing in that movie is phenomenal.
Hmm.
Carrie at number six.
Number six? Wow. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I love Carrie. Carrie is so very.
Too.
Me too. I mean,
I would put that at like maybe two or three.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me too. Me too. So what do they put ahead of it? They put ahead of it Misery at number five.
Okay.
I don't think Misery holds a candle to Carrie.
No, but
yeah, I would have put Misery like down like maybe 10 or 12 or something.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say 50. I mean, I would have the Children of the Corn ahead of it.
Yeah, switch Misery with Dead Zone or something. Stand By Me at number four.
Mm-hmm.
Number three. No. Number three is The Green Mile on their list.
What?
I like it, but
that's
I would put it much lower. I like the movie, but I would put it much lower. It's not, I wouldn't, you know, I'm sorry. It's good, but it ain't great. I mean.
Yeah. Number two is The Shining.
Oh, my God. What's
so
number?
That
number
means we
one
know
is.
What number one is.
Well, that means that it can only be one movie. We've already been through 49 of them.
Yeah. Oh my God! It's every politician's favorite movie.
Yeah, The Shawshank Redemption. That's true. They came out with a report that said The Shawshank Redemption is one of those movies that appeal to both Republicans and Democrats equally.
Yeah. No, but if you ever read, a politician, I remember there's a period where they ask them what their favorite movie was. They always say like The Shawshank Redemption. It's always shown.
It's the movie loving equivalent of kissing a baby for a politician. Yeah,
and it's a really good movie too. But I mean, I don't know. I would have put some of the others ahead of it, but that's just me.
Yeah.
Well, I still agree with Jerry that Dead Zone is the best one.
One thing we just don't, because it's really cool for a lot of reasons. First of all, it's Cronenberg, you know, doing a great adaptation as he always does, I think. But it's also Walken and not his typical, you know, Walken.
Walken's beautiful in it.
Yeah,
hell,
I mean, he's
yeah.
just it's a very moving performance.
And that's it. I mean, it's just the plot alone. It's such a crackerjack plot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just so visceral. And the Walken and Cronenberg the depth of emotion in
yeah.
it, and just the dynamic that he saved the world and everyone, and he died, and everyone thinks that he's insane, and he just tried to assassinate the, you know.
Right.
It's such a touching, tragic kind of thing to it that you don't expect.
Yeah.
There's a line reading that he has in that movie that is just incredible. You know,
the ice is going to break.
No, it's when he's.
It's gonna break.
It's when he describes what happens to him when he has the vision.
Right.
And he's like, I feel like I'm dying inside. You know, it's like this great. That's wonderful. I started doing like Christopher Walken in these different. Movies, like, you know, what if Christopher Walken were in United 93 or something? The plane is going down. Smoke them if you got Yeah.
Oh, my God.
All right. So that's our list for the
night. That was
classic,
Jamie.
Dean, what's new with you, man?
Oh, nothing. The night watching movies last night in our theater over here. Tried to come up with, everybody was asking for happy movies. And you know how hard it is to come up with happy movies? Like movies that are just, you know, that leave you feeling good. It's difficult.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, can you name any, like, what are the happiest movies that you can name? Like, you know.
The Dead Zone? No.
I mean, it is passively in the sense that, you know, the world isn't destroyed. So,
Gene's not going to be president, but
yeah.
Quite a contrast to the character he played on The West Wing, though. I always found that interesting.
Yeah, that is. But
yeah,
that's
quite a question. Like, what movies put a smile on my face? I know there are movies that do.
Like E.T. or...
Why don't they come to mind?
I'm not happy people.
I think it's, you know, I just like went to go and buy some movies at a local, like, you know, trade-in bookshop, you know. Here.
Comedies.
Guy there. I said, can you think of any happy movies? He said, no, I can't think of any movies that make you feel, like, happy without making you feel like you're being manipulated or whatever.
Well, comedies, dude, are, like, good, like something like Animal House or Stripes or something, or there's something about Mary. I mean, would that count, or...
Well, comedies, the thing about that is that a lot of comedies...
Best
Anna
made me happy.
...kind of trade on a sort of meanness, you know, and
no, to an extent,
they don't quite make
right.
you happy. They might make you laugh, but they don't necessarily make you happy.
So you're looking for good-hearted movies is what you're looking for.
Yeah, like good-hearted, you know, happy movies, you know, I mean...
My dog Skip.
Yeah, but there was a movie that I just recently talked about that was good-hearted. Like, it was a movie with a good heart. I even reviewed it and said that this is the heart's in the right place. What the heck was that movie? As Good as It Gets is a movie that always made me happy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to look on my blog
see. Obviously, it's not what we need to talk about, Kevin. That's not the one.
Well, last night I showed...
Cameron Crowe. Like, most Cameron Crowe movies are good-hearted.
Yeah, I mean, really, they are. And We Bought a Zoo would definitely, I think.
That's true about Cameron Crowe. That is true. They are good-hearted movies.
You're not going to want to commit suicide when you walk out of the theater.
Right.
A lot of Woody Allen's are good-hearted or happier.
Definitely,
yeah.
I would put in that category.
I don't know if they're good-hearted. I mean, there is no God and no hope. But but within
well,
those constraints,
Hannah and her sisters at the end makes you.
Yeah, I think Hannah and her sisters, but. Yeah.
Obviously
I think
not crimes and misdemeanors, maybe, but...
September. Recommend September. Like, recommend the most depressing movie that you don't think they know anything about. Like, and they'll be like, okay, thanks, I'll check that out. You'd be like, Melancholia is...
Melancholia and then Antichrist.
Yeah.
It's so much easier to, like, make a list of the most depressing movies, though, because...
Yeah.
That's easy.
Yeah, that's easy. But maybe it's because we all can't, like, really, like, define what happiness... You know, it's difficult to define what happiness is for each of us, you know.
Funny game.
So.
Funny. Yeah, anything by Michael Haneke. Michael Haneke
yeah.
is the last
Michael Haneke makes the happiest movies ever.
Michael Haneke,
yeah,
what? Right. Was he a Fox correspondent all of a sudden? Yeah, that's true. The great movies are typically the most depressing ones.
What about Sullivan's Travels? What about, like, Preston Sturges, you know, Sullivan's Travels and Hail the Conquering Hero? Would you consider those...
Miracle of Morgan Creek. They're easier to find, like, if you go back into the 50s and 40s, you know, you can also pick some musicals like Music Man or...
Bringing a Baby or...
Yeah.
Ninotchka or, like, things like that. A lot of the comedy of manners, Trouble in Paradise, I mean...
Right.
I tell you what's not a happy movie, and I finally got around to watching it. I didn't talk about this last time.
Okay, uh-oh.
We were all together. Is My Week with Marilyn. So I finally watched it.
Is that out on DVD already, or?
It comes out today, or came out yesterday, or next week, or something. I'm not sure. But I watched it, and I found it really heartbreaking, that movie.
Oh, it is. I mean.
I like really kind of smashingly effective in parts, and I think that the part where it succeeds the most is in kind of portraying the need for validation, the lack of self-esteem, the kind of fragility that is only magnified by stardom. And, of course, Marilyn is like the poster person for that. But the most telling scene for me was the one with Branna, where he talks about, you know, I actually admire Marilyn, and I thought that she would, you know, bring me back to life in this, but I just look more dead than I ever have standing beside her. You know, the old pro feels the same sense of lack of self-esteem and fragility that Marilyn does in his own way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a very special portrayal of particularly the artists and how they suffer from those qualities.
Yeah, I agree. I love that movie, but it's a little clunky when it first starts out. I think, you know, but until Marilyn comes on, when she comes on, it goes through the stratosphere. It's, you know,
yeah,
a great performance.
I agree. I mean, it's not a perfect movie by any means, but once the emotional resonance of it starts to take hold, it's really effective.
Mm-hmm.
You get the feeling, you get a real palpable feeling, too, that she's, like, trying to, you know, her relationship with the character that Eddie Redmayne plays, you get the sense that, you know, she's trying to recreate, you know, a more innocent time for herself. Like, she's, like, going... It's almost like she's going on her first date or something like that, you
mm-hmm.
know, when they go out together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very sweet and wonderful.
And plus at the same time, I mean, it doesn't shy away from showing how needy she is and that she's in need of that adoration,
mm-hmm.
you know, that isn't tarnished by or informed necessarily by her superstardom or that, you know.
I liked how they stayed away from. They only referred to her, you know, addiction to drugs, like very on a very sideways kind of way. They didn't really harp on it too much,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think you might have seen like a bottle of pills on the bedroom table or whatever. But
mm-hmm.
other than that, you know, they didn't really talk about it that much.
Yeah.
So there weren't any scenes of her coming in all looped and everything, you know, and trying to do scenes and flubbing them up and everything.
So what else have I seen? I got the Blu-ray. I went on a Blu-ray buying spree. I got the Blu-ray to Taxi Driver, There Will Be Blood, Dressed to Kill, Last Tango in Paris, the Citizen Kane box set, Amadeus, Gone with the Wind. I got in The Conversation, which is great. Hey, and First Blood. Here's a couple of movies. And the Two Tinker Tailors came in, like the Blu-ray
oh, cool.
of the new movie and the miniseries.
Oh,
which
awesome.
I never saw the miniseries, so I'll check that out. But there's a piece of commentary on First Blood, and I wanted to hear Stallone. I don't know why I was in the mood to hear Stallone talk about the movie. Richard Crenna, you know, he plays his colonel in that movie.
Right.
In all the series. Richard Crenna was a last-minute addition. I mean, really last minute, because Kirk Douglas was playing that part.
Oh, wow.
So Kirk Douglas shows up that first day to shoot his first scene, and he has his script all marked with these yellow little sticky notes. And he says, Sly, I want to change this and this and this, completely making it a different movie and more making it about his own character. And this is the first day of his shooting. And Stallone says, well, we can't do any of that. These are wacky ideas. So what do you want to do? And Kirk Douglas said, I quit. So he walked off. I mean, something tells me Kirk Douglas ultimately didn't want to do it to begin with, and he was just making himself impossible so he could get out of it. But so he walked off, and they're stuck with, who are we going to cast in a day? And so they find Richard Crenna. He comes in the next day. It's even so bad, so rushed, that he's wearing Kirk Douglas's uniform. The pants come up above his ankles, so they got to shoot him from, like, you know, above his ankles up that day. So his first scene, Brian Dennehy's in a tent. Brian Dennehy says something like, who the heck made this Rambo guy? And the colonel says, I did. Now, Richard Crenna was just pulled from a show on stage where he played a gay professor.
Mm.
So here he is playing this army colonel. He does his first take. Brian did it. He's like, who the hell made this Rambo character? And Krennic pops up and he says, I did. And still in his other character. And Stallone was like, no, that won't do. That won't do. I laughed so hard when I heard that commentary.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, that was really good. And then I also watched The War Room again, because that's out on Criterion Blu-ray. I hadn't seen it since, it was first released, so it's been since the early 90s. And not only did it feel like it was a great kind of return to, I mean, it was a great insight into campaigning and when a moment when campaigns changed and the war room was kind of invented, but it also felt like a return to, when I first became politically conscious and, what is now looked upon as a more glorious time in my life.
Right. But let me ask you very serious question about that. Do you think it's possible to make a documentary as riveting as that, given that we now we have all the social media, the internet, and the 24-hour news networks are much more prevalent? Because at that time, I think you only had CNN and headline news. And
there's
much saturation now.
Right. Well, and the thing covers the relationship with the press and how they can kind of maneuver the press to their advantage. So there's always been the press scrutiny. I mean, not to this level. I just I think it would be a lot sadder documentary today.
I agree with you.
A lot more depressing. But what makes the documentary special isn't Bill Clinton. It's not the candidate. It's the fact that they found a major character. They just happened upon him in James Carville.
Yeah.
You know? That's what makes the movie pop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get this guy.
You're absolutely right.
He was on Bill Maher a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, he was.
Wearing the most awful looking shirt.
Yeah, it was pretty awful, as I remember. Yes.
Brightly colored stripes.
Yeah. Oh, the lighting guy must have had a field day with that.
So I'm watching The War Room. There's a segment in The War Room where he's wearing the exact same shirt.
Wow.
So he's had that thing in his closet for at least 20 years. He just pulled it on to go.
Mary, I'm breaking this out. I'm going to wear it on Bill Maher tonight.
Bill Maher. I thought that was so hysterical.
Yeah.
I mean, he looked like a redneck Dr. Seuss. I mean, that was in that shirt. Yeah.
I was watching Assassination of Jesse James on the big screen over here and the other night, and I always forget that he's in it.
That's right. That's right.
As the governor of, Missouri or something like that.
That's right. Yeah.
And
he's in Old School too.
Right. Well, he has a couple of great scenes in Assassination of Jesse James. And it's perfect casting.
It is, yeah.
He's really terrific. He actually, has the scene that kind of turns the action. Leads the movie into the third act or whatever. But he's great in that. He should do more acting. Have you guys ever seen K Street, by the way?
The HBO series.
Yeah, the HBO. I remember that. Yeah.
He's pretty good in that too. That's a fascinating show. I mean, it only went for 6 episodes, I think, but it's really fascinating. It's hard to tell where the script writing begins and the improv. So it's very fascinating. One of my favorite Soderbergh projects.
Well, the new Andrew Dominik movie.
Is it Kogan's Trade or?
Yeah, it was called Kogan's Trade.
Title.
Now it's called Killing Them Softly is what it's called now. But we were on Jason's show, or I was on Jason's show, and we were doing our most anticipated movies of 2012, and that was on my list.
Definitely
on my list. I fully expect that to be
the
New York Film Festival this year.
I guess they really liked that Roberta Flack song. I don't know.
Is that the name of a, isn't that the name of a movie with Heather Graham from many years ago?
You're right.
Well, you know, they don't care about
You're right,
that
it
anymore.
It is.
Yeah, but I mean,
they don't,
you know,
care,
they don't
about
care about
that anymore.
Yeah, they and they haven't for
There's a
decades.
New movie coming out called Somebody Up There Likes Me.
I
know?
Saw, yeah. Yeah, I know that's it. But I mean, I realized
I cared about it. That was Heather Graham's 9.5 weeks right there. I mean, that was kind of.
Yeah, but I mean, it just seems like
it was hot.
And now, granted, no one's a lot of people because I think Kelly the Heather Graham movie was went straight to video.
Yeah, that's a straight to video title. Like nobody cares.
Straight
well, I realize
to my
no
video.
One cares about that. But I mean, it just seems like I thought, you know, Kogan Straight is was a good title. I mean,
yeah, me
know,
too.
Think, all right, so.
It reminded me a little bit of Coogan's Bluff, to tell you the truth.
Man,
so
that's
I was
that.
Like,
no, I was thinking that too. But I mean, well, either way, neither the movie going on today is not going to remember that one either. So I mean,
no, but at least that's been on television a few times. Like you know.
Do you? So, what are your most anticipated off the top of your head, guys?
Lincoln is number one for me. I mean,
Lincoln's number one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Django Unchained is obviously number one with a close tie with The Dark Knight Rises, The Avengers, Kogan's Trade, The Hobbit, Skyfall. Tell me when you want me to shut up. The John Hillcoat movie, what is it, the wettest county in the world. Oh, there's so many of them. I mean, but yeah, I'm naming like obviously the big ones, but the big ones.
I mean, that sounds
Damsels
like an adult
in Distress,
film right there.
Moonrise Kingdom, Dark Shadows. Like I said, tell
Man,
me
Man, you're
shut
naming
up.
Them all. I mean, why would you be looking forward to Dark Shadows, really? You know it's going to be bad.
Well, it's Tim Burton and Johnny Depp, and I know that doesn't
yeah,
mean anything.
Yeah, but what? They haven't done a good movie. They haven't done a good movie since 1990.
But we always hold out. We always hold out hope. That,
no, but
that,
Sweeney Todd
yeah.
I liked, actually. So I actually thought Sweeney Todd was excellent, so...
I've given up on that director. I won't go see anything that he's done.
You know, he
I,
wrote
unless,
me today,
everybody
Dean, you know, he
himself.
Wrote me today, and he said, I love Dean Treadway. I love when he comes on the show. I love when Jamie plays the music from Dean. It makes me feel good.
Well, good for him.
He said, I
now,
love Dean Treadway, and I
be,
want
get
him
back,
to go see my movie.
My message to him would be, now get back to making some good movies for a change.
Well, the thing about Tim Burton is... I mean, he has such incredible talent, but I mean, his finished movies are kind of spotty. But occasionally, and you never know what will happen, he just hits it. You know.
I thought he hit it with Sweeney Todd, personally. So.
Sweeney Todd's very good, in my opinion too. Ed Wood, I think we all can agree, he hit it there.
Yes.
So you never know when Tim Burton's going to come through, and you know. Prometheus is another.
Oh, Prometheus is a big is a oh
that's,
a huge.
That's the biggest sort of like, you know, popcorn summer movie that I'm looking forward to is Prometheus.
Yeah,
for sure.
No, that's definitely. There's another. There's Moonrise Kingdom looks good. Damsels in Distress. Oh God.
I'm not so sure about those two filmmakers anymore either.
Well, Whit Stillman hasn't done anything since 1998, so I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Now,
well,
Wes Anderson,
to tell you the truth,
I've
never been a big Whit Stillman fan. You know, he's sort of like Hal Hartley. There's just something about the performances in those movies.
There's something. There's a reaction I have. I have the same kind of reaction about who's the guy that does that did Moonrise Kingdom and.
Wes Anderson, but his last movie was, I thought, The Fantastic Mr. Fox was fantastic. I mean,
well, yeah,
I didn't,
that was good.
I actually didn't see that one, but there's just something about me that
resists. That's a good, happy movie, by the way.
There's something about me that just resists his style for some reason. I mean, it's just a personal
kind. Well, let me
kinda...
ask you that. Do you think it's like Sofia Coppola? He needs to work. He needs to really work, get outside his comfort zone.
Maybe.
I mean,
maybe.
That's what everyone gave Sofia Coppola a hard time with somewhere about that. So. It
mm-hmm.
could be the same with Wes Anderson.
There's
people
a
do
Catherine.
Not like people. When that trailer debuted, a lot of people went after him for that trailer.
There's a new
well,
Catherine Bigelow movie.
Oh, that's the one about Ben Laden. Yeah, that's the end of the year.
The Master. Paul Thomas.
The Master.
Actually,
yeah.
I hope that's this year. I hope.
Yeah.
That's
that was
that's
that was on my
list.
They're thinking that's going to be October that comes out.
World War Z was postponed till next summer.
I think it's a smart move.
Oh, it's a very smart move. To release it when they're going to release it, you've got to be crazy.
Yeah, but they did what they did, I think, or pretty much no, because they moved up the Tom Cruise. They wanted Tom Cruise to have the same weekend where he had a hit with Mission Impossible 4 for his new action movie, One Shot. So because they moved that, they didn't want two big studio tentpole movies at the same time, so they moved World War Z, the Brad Pitt, a summer movie. A zombie apocalypse movie with Brad Pitt. I think that was pretty smart.
I think it was smart to move. It was just smart to move that. But I didn't really. Well, they really want One Shot this year. I know they. I mean, it's not something to bet against, but it's just to be a crowded December. I mean, forget the summer. December is looking.
Well, you know, it's always like that. And so
yeah,
like, that seems to be the.
I do want
the
to see Rock of Ages.
Yeah.
Rock of Ages looks good.
That could be one of those fun movies.
Mm-hmm.
Happy movie.
Something you'd be happy, Dean. You're not going to walk out and blow your brains out afterwards.
That's if you like hair metal. If you don't like hair metal, you'll want to blow your brains out.
I think this actually has a chance to be a very nostalgic kind of movie for like Gen Xers and I think the generation before that. So don't bet against that. That could
work.
Well,
Cruise is doing his own singing. Am I correct on that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So
we don't really know how well Cruise sings, but you know.
He can lip sync the hell out of
like
Bob Seger.
Could be a major disaster. You have to.
It could not. We'll see.
Most great movies could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
Hey,
yeah.
You know Bill Murray might get a Best Actor nomination come next year.
Oh, yeah, for the one where he's FDR?
Yeah.
That one sounds good. That's got a great cast.
Mm-hmm.
He looks like the guy on the pickle jar, though, with that thing in his eye and the kind of squinting like he is.
Have they come out with a photo of him?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that.
What's the one movie you're dreading more than anything?
Oh, I'm kind of dreading The Dark Knight Rises, to tell you the truth. I'm already tired of hearing about it.
That's one person on the planet.
Yeah, one person.
Yeah.
All right, you're just going against the grain on that one.
I mean,
Jerry, what about you? What are you dreading?
I don't know if it's I haven't really seen. I'm not dreading anything because if they cut me into the grosses, I'm really not going to dread any of them. You know, if someone gives me some of the grosses, have fun. You know, fun. Hey, Battleship looks stupid as hell, but make a lot of money. Hey, you guys, you're going to cut me in the gross? Dude, it's the best fucking movie I've ever seen.
Oh my god. Battleship
and Wrath of the Titans, those would be.
Wrath of the Titans. Yeah, I mean, Clash of Titans wasn't very good. The remake wasn't very good. And now Wrath of the Titans looks like, hey, these are all the outtakes from Immortals. Go figure.
That new Eddie Murphy movie looks pretty bad.
Oh,
it already came and went,
it sounds like. So.
You know, that movie.
Has it opened yet?
Yeah,
it opened Friday.
Wow.
It closed Saturday morning. You know, that movie was finished in 2008.
Yeah.
It got it's like one of the rare movies to get a zero on Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. Sunday is. Oh, God, remind me again. Abel Ferrara.
Mm-hmm.
The love story between myself and Abel Ferrara will be told on Sunday.
I can't wait to hear this. I mean, Jesus.
It's just 1 second, but it was like the oddest feeling. It's just the oddest feeling to say, I love you too, man. The day to Abel Ferrara and hang up the phone. And we'll also have Mark Travis, who's written a book, The Film Director's Bag of Tricks. Wednesday, Barry Bostwick. And then I think we're putting the Mr. Rogers documentarians on after Barry Bostwick next Wednesday.
Okay, cool.
Then Sunday will be
Morgan
Spurlock and Joe Eisenberg. His book on Carrie, Studies in the Horror Film, in which we are sourced 3 times,
awesome.
Is finally available for purchase, and he'll come on our show 2 weeks Sunday to talk about it. Mid-April, Music on Film, the end of April, Full Metal Jacket. So,
all right, cool.
Hey.
Quite a lineup.
Yep. So let's play out with our final interview of the night. Dino, you want to call back on Sunday?
Yeah, I'll call back.
All right, cool.
Okay, I'm going to take you at your word.
All right. I'll talk to you then.
Okay. Thanks, Dean.
Have fun.
Good night.
Bye.
Oh, damn. I was late with the sound thing. Sorry. All right. I tried to play him off, but I couldn't. Okay. Our last guest is Todd Click. He has a new book out called Something Startling Happens. It's a screenwriting book. It tells you the 120 story beats every writer needs to know, which is a lot of books talk about, you know, this is where you need this plot point and that plot point. He goes minute by minute in a 120-minute movie to say, and apparently all of these movies, he takes about, you know, many, many movies, each of these movies kind of follow the same beats minute to minute. So it's a kind of a key to a successful screenwriting book. It's available for purchase now. You can purchase it from our homepage by clicking the link on the title. And we're going to close out the show with Todd Click talking about his book.
Cool.
Thank you, Jerry.
No, thank you. A lot of fun as always. And I will see you and everyone else on Sunday.
Sounds good, man.
All right.
Take it easy, baby.
You too. Thanks.
I love you.
I love you too.
I want to end every conversation with that.
Really.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Here's Todd Click. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
My passion for film started back in Pennsylvania, where I used to go to the Key Drive-In, which is now a Walmart parking lot of all things. It makes me very sad. But I just thought movies were so magical, and I it is something I did every week. My family went, or my friends and I went. And as I grew older, I remember I was at a farmer's market where a lot of Amish people go to get their produce and their vegetables and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of quirky things you can find there. And I remember I was a teenager, and I saw this guy had a box of screenplays, which, you know, it never occurred to me that people wrote movies. And I found Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. Mm. And this thing was like, I don't know, the heavens opened up when I read this thing and I saw how it's formatted. And then I thought, oh, my God, to make a living writing movies, oh, my God, that would be the best living of all. And so I started to really study scripts. I started studying movies, not just watching them, but really breaking down, you know, how they work and that kind of thing. And I was back home then. I was writing for theater at the time, and I was really getting a great lesson in storytelling then, because a friend and I would write sketches and we'd perform them in coffee shops all over the area, and just to get a live audience, you know, to test a sketch out that you wrote the night before was great for learning drama. You got really keep tension in each scene and conflict, and dialogue's got to be sharp or it's just going to fall flat. And so it was a great training ground. And then, I eventually wanted to tell bigger stories. So I co-wrote a play about Milton Hershey that did really well, sold out in the area for 3 years straight. And, but again, you know, my love of movies kept drawing me back, so I started making my own short films, and then made a documentary called Rough Cut, The Murder of Randy Trimble, that got me on Dateline NBC and a few festivals around the country. And then I eventually got out to LA here, and oh my gosh, you know, ever since what I was studying for the book, I started applying to my scripts, and things have really taken off for me, which is amazing, you know, for a Pennsylvania farm boy, basically, you know.
Well, you know, we've seen kind of breakdowns that say within this page and this page, or this minute and this minute, you need to do this. You know, this is the inciting incident. This is the, you know, the climax. What have you? But your approach actually goes minute by minute, beat by beat. So when did that start to develop for you?
I've read all the screenwriting books too. They go into three-act structure and inciting incident, midpoint, and turning points, that kind of thing. I remember I was, I go into it a little bit in the book, I was in Gettysburg at the time to study the Civil War battles and everything, and one hot, I think it was like an August night, I popped in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I did what I called breakdowns, did a yellow legal pad, and I go scene by scene and write a paragraph of what exactly was happening, you know. And I did this for so many movies leading up to that point, and I realized there was a, especially during minute eight, there was a certain dynamic, this nuance that was happening during every single movie during that minute, and it was where I got the name for the book eventually. It was something startling would happen, usually to the hero, and there's usually like this little moment of silence right before it happens too. And in Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's when Indy has the he wants that little golden idol head, and he's got the sandbag, and he switches them, and then there's a moment of silence, and then all hell breaks loose, his whole temple crumbles on him, and he starts racing out of there. And I was like, wait a minute. So I went over, I checked out the Matrix, my paragraphs on that, and it's like minute eight, wow, that's when Neo's in his apartment, and he's emailing back and forth with Trinity, and she writes, knock, knock, Neo, and right then there's a loud knock on the door that startles the hell out of him, and I start going through, I mean, I must have had, at that time, about 150 movies that I had broken down, which is now expanded to over, God, it must be like 300, 350. I was like looking for that nuance. And every minute there would be a startling moment. And this was great for me as a screenwriter because I knew, oh, wow, this makes sense because you need these little kicker moments before you get to the inciting incident to keep an audience plastered in their seats and their eyes glued to the screen. And I was like, wow, I could kind of see why you need these little things. You need a jaw dropper at five, and the minute eight, something startling happens before you get to that moment. You know, really, you know, it's a little trick that the pros use. And it's like, wow, this is really cool.
Well, and you're, you know, you go through as if it's a 120-minute film. So you answer it in the book, but and I've seen you answer it in other interviews that you've done. But what if it's not a 120-minute film?
if it's underneath that, yeah, I did. Or if it's more than that, yeah. What's fascinating about it is that, for example, Halloween, John Carpenter's Halloween ends at 86. And Jaws, for example, goes, you know, the full 2 hours. And their beats match exactly the same up until 86. And then Jaws ends, and then, or I'm sorry, Halloween ends, and then Jaws continues. And every movie does that. And why that is because different movies have different stuff going on different characters have to be developed differently for different kind of movies and genres, that kind of thing. So the more subplots you have going on, the larger your movie's going to be eventually. And but underneath it all, there's this universal rhythm that happens that hits minute by minute. And how this came to be is, this started way back in with Shakespeare and Moliere. I was breaking down Hamlet recently, and these great storytellers way back would have the same kind of like a jaw dropper moment in Hamlet was the dead the ghost of his father shows up, and it's like, whoa, you know, they didn't expect something like that to happen. And but there's little tricks that the playwrights used back then to keep an audience gripped. And but plays would fluctuate night by night depending on the rhythm of the actors, if they were tired, if they were energized, feeding off the audience. But in film, screenwriters started borrowing from theater writers. A lot of them were theater writers going into writing for film. Film is locked into place once it gets out there to the audience. And so they found this rhythm of, you know, these beats that they had to hit underneath to keep an audience in their seats. And if they didn't keep an audience in their seats, these producers, these directors, they'd lose their homes, you know. So this is really high stakes for them early on in filmmaking, still today. So they learned these rhythms from theater and applied them and honed them for film. And, you know, it's still used today.
So it is, because you'd mentioned that you'd written for theater. So these rules for cinema apply to theatrical writing as well, would you say?
Yeah, totally. I used to do this stuff just from writing a lot of plays and studying plays. It was before I studied the beats underneath everything. It's something that when you see a lot of plays or films or whatever, you start to learn a rhythm. Like, it starts to, when you're writing, you start to ache, like, oh, wait, something, there needs to be this jolt moment here. You know what I mean? You just feel it when you're writing. But when you actually analyze the plays and films, you start to see, it's like light bulbs go off, like, oh, I see what's going on. Like, oh, they're doing this here, they're doing that there. And there's a specific reason. It's all to get into this rhythm of a great story that satisfies an audience.
And how much room is there to play in this? When you look at the minute by minute beats, can some of them be interchangeable?
No. I wouldn't interchange them because they're locked into place. This is, you know, something that's been honed for the last, in film anyway, 100 years, and it's going to continue to go on because it's a successful model. All the successful movies are doing this. But what I suggest and what I do is, I don't go by, now I know from studying them, I know a lot of these beats subconsciously. So, but I let my first draft, I just go by total instinct of where the story is leading me, where the characters are leading me, and I let the creativity just flow. But after I do rewrites from, you know, critiquers, I start to hone and tighten, and then I start to study the rhythms that I mentioned in the book, until I get the script really, really going, that's really, really a tight read. That's what a lot of people say about my scripts out here, is they read really tight. That's because I'm getting them down to the rhythm of these beats that I studied.
Right. But have you ever seen a or studied a film that did not play by these beats at all, or...?
Yeah, what was there? There was one. But yeah, the ones that I have, they haven't been successful.
Right.
It's considered the worst movie of all time is Troll 2. It's just a mess. And the movies that bomb seem to, they have some of the beats because, you know, you do need to hit these beats to have a basic movie going on. But the unsuccessful movies, they lose their way a lot of the times, where successful films will hit a majority of the beats down the line.
Mm-hmm. And then you have directors that you know, somebody like an Altman that was never necessarily interested in a classically kind of structured movie.
It's funny you brought that up, because I'm going to be studying Altman this summer, and I'm also going to be studying Fellini and Truffaut and a lot of the European writers as well, or directors as well. I want to see how they interpret a story, that kind of thing. But I can't give you a definitive answer on Altman yet, although I'm a big fan of The Player. I love that movie, but I haven't broken down his movies yet, so I can't really tell you.
You know what? I'm sure that The Player actually adheres pretty closely to the beats outlined in this book. I mean, because The Player is kind of a takeoff on successful Hollywood filmmaking, so it probably does. Is writing what kind of process is writing for you? Is it painful? Is it a joy? Is it easy? Does it come easy for you? What is that like for you?
It's a complete joy. I can't wait to get up in the morning to do it. I usually start 8 a.m. and write till about 2, just about every day, 6 to 7 days a week. And I feel blessed to have this time to write. I went through, when I left a regular job, it was about 6 years ago now, and to have, people pay me to write now, and I make my living as a screenwriter, and it's just fantastic. So I feel like it's a privilege, and it's a fun privilege, and so I'm very disciplined with it, though. I'm very hardworking at it, because I didn't always have this precious time to write. So, I write every day, and I'm working on some story, and I'm working on the one I'm passionate about at the time. Sometimes I have lines. I just got hired to develop a couple Broadway musicals, and which I'm having a blast doing.
Wow.
And sometimes I have deadlines at different stages of the story development. So, I make that the main focus. And then in between that, I'm pushing forward other scripts and that kind of thing.
Wow, have you had feedback on this book?
Yeah, oh my gosh, yeah, it's just it's been unbelievable. I wrote this book. It wasn't really a book. I wrote all the stuff I was learning from breaking down all these movies with a literal stopwatch for my own betterment as a writer. I wasn't thinking about, I'll put this out to the world or something. It was only a couple of years after I was doing that, I would share some of what I was learning with professional screenwriters out here in L.A., and they're like, oh, man, yeah, oh, yeah, I used that minute 8 thing all the time, that could be where I do this at this certain minute, and they knew they know these beats instinctively, not as extensively as I went into, and so they're like, you should put this out as a book, and I was like, oh wow, I never even considered that, and they said this would be tremendously helpful, And I'm a big fan of screenwriting books. It's how I learn the craft, and by reading screenplays and stuff. And I got the number one publisher of film television books, Michael Wiese, MWP. They love the book. They said no one had ever, done something like that. And so they were thrilled to take it on. And now it's expanded out to in 5 countries now. And
wow.
Went into second printing, just after 2 months out there, and I'm getting emails literally from all over the world from writers that it's helping, and that's the biggest thrill for me. It's like, wow.
Every time I talk to a screenwriter, I always have to close with the same question. What are 3 kind of essential screenplays for you that you would recommend our listeners pick up and read if they're really interested in the art form?
Oh boy, that's a fantastic question. Can I give you 2 that are just outstanding in my mind right now?
Sure.
Is Robert Towne's Chinatown, which is exquisite, and a polar kind of opposite is Tootsie, the old school like 80s Tootsie, starring Dustin Hoffman, and it's just great. And now a third one is Die Hard. If you want to really, Die Hard is great in showing characters right off the bat and capturing them quickly. And mm-hmm. and then, you know, as it's also driving the story forward. Those are three wildly different ones, but they're great to study. And I had the privilege of meeting Robert Towne over in Brentwood. I stopped by one of the markets over there, and I saw him strolling out, you know, to his black Lexus. And I was like, oh, my God, are you Robert? And he's like, yeah. And I said, oh, my God, I've studied your work and seen him a couple times now. And I was like, wow, I can't believe, you know, the guy is so amazing what he's pulled off throughout the years.